From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in 1973 with a headline in the New York Times. Here it was, quote, "In Venezuela, good times are going." Venezuela was once the richest country in Latin America, with the largest oil reserves in the world, and throughout the 1970s, mainstream American media praised its democratic government. You might know that these are not the headlines from American mainstream media coming out of Venezuela today. Vox reports that democracy in Venezuela is in shambles. The Cato Institute reports that the inflation rate there has exploded. Vox reports that food and medicine are now inaccessible to most Venezuelans. There are now regular protests in the street against President Nicolas Maduro. Data analysis polls show 80% of Venezuelans want him removed from office. But Maduro has been consolidating power, and the Washington Post says that Venezuela is moving toward authoritarian rule. So what happened? And what lessons can we learn from it? And can we trust the reports coming out of Venezuela? The Rochester Committee on Latin America has brought a guest to town to deliver a presentation titled, "What's the Matter with Venezuela?" And it turns out the media might not always paint the picture that our guest thinks should be painted if we want an accurate story there. Let me go ahead and welcome him now. Alexander Main is a senior associate for international policy at the Center for Economic Policy Research in Washington, D.C. Alex, welcome to the program. Thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me on.
And Grania Marcus is here, a member of the steering committee for the Rochester Committee on Latin America. And Grania, a couple of things here. Let's start with what ROCLA, as the shorthand is, what it is and what the mission is of ROCLA first.
The Rochester Committee on Latin America was founded in 1973, so it's 45 years old, at the time of the when Salvador Allende in Chile was overthrown with the assistance of the U.S. government. What ROCLA does, its mission is working in solidarity and contributing financially to over 20 groups in Latin America and solidarity groups in the United States. As a mission, we support and work in solidarity with social movements in Latin America, and other groups working there. And then we also support the Latino communities in the United States, so the Latin American diaspora here in the U.S. And that includes in our own area.
There's an event tonight that ROCLA is putting on, 7 p.m. at the Downtown Presbyterian Church. That's on North Fitzhugh Street. And Grania, the event at 7 p.m. at the Downtown Presbyterian Church tonight is free and open to the public?
Yes, it is. It's open to the public, and the church is looped for the those with hearing loss, and it's accessible to those with mobility impairments.
One of the things that Alex has to endure when he talks to media in many platforms is sort of the shortening of attention spans of media. The nice thing about this conversation is we get to have a conversation at length about issues in Venezuela, about media coverage, and more. But let me start with a bit of an elevator pitch, a request from you. If you're telling the audience what they can expect tonight at 7 p.m., what's the goal of your presentation this evening?
Well, I think the goal, and there's, I think, a quick description that you can see on the ROCLA page, but it's basically to go beyond the headlines that you often see on Venezuela that, describe it as a country that's in free fall, a socialist dictatorship, a real nightmare, and, without real context, and I think without going into real depth in terms of, what's created the situation that it's undoubtedly a huge crisis that we're seeing in Venezuela today. But what are the real factors behind that? And that, in fact, the current government bears a lot of responsibility, but there are other important actors as well that include opposition forces in Venezuela and also the United States government.
All right, so a lot to work through, and I want to start by kind of examining the way the American media has framed the narrative that most of us who've tried to pay some attention have understood it. And I think not just in the last year, but for a number of years. And so let's kind of work through a piece that Vox had not only an article on Vox.com, but also an explainer video piece that had 1.8 million views last year. when unrest was sort of starting to roil there. So Vox reported that in 2004, oil prices around the world surged and that Chavez used some of the billions in profits to do a number of things, to subsidize food, to improve health care, and to fund education. Poverty was reduced by a rate of around 60% to less than 30 at that time, and that Chavez did use many of those billions to help the poor in Venezuela. But there was a caveat with it, and I want to listen to the Vox video explainer piece talking about what came next and how they view a lot of the seeds of what's going on in Venezuela now.
In order to be reelected, he needed to keep these millions of poor Venezuelans happy. So he rigged the economy to do just that. He didn't scale back Venezuela's dependence on oil, and his unrestrained spending led to a growing deficit, which meant all these programs would be impossible to sustain if oil prices fell. After Chavez's death, when Maduro took office as his handpicked successor, that's exactly what happened. Oil prices plummeted in 2014, and Maduro failed to adjust.
All right, so what Vox is reporting is that the moves by Chavez, especially after the spike in oil prices in 2004, did help people, but they were, number one, not sustainable. Spending was unrestrained, and it was done largely for political purposes. That's the frame that a lot of Americans understand what's going on in Venezuela. How do you view it?
Well, you know, part of that is true. It was done for political purposes, but the political purpose in this case was really to help the poor and to decrease, the huge levels of inequality in the country, which were absolutely staggering at the end of the 1990s, after two decades of, what is known as neoliberalism. So a set of policies also known as the Washington Consensus, promoted by international financial institutions, including the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, and the World Bank, that pushed a lot of countries, not just Venezuela, but certainly a lot of middle-income countries in Latin America, to radically change their policies to downsize the public sector, reduce the role of the state in the national economies, to reduce social programs, to carry out sweeping privatizations, and to deregulate, markets, both the trade system and also the internal labor markets and so on. And this resulted in a long period of economic stagnation in these countries and of growing inequality. And Venezuela was hit particularly hard. When Hugo Chavez was first elected in 1998, he was a completely outsider candidate. And he was really seen as a sort of a symbol of resistance to all of this. And, you know, particularly by the poor, but also a lot of the middle classes that had suffered during this period, that had really seen their prospects for having better lives, just go down the toilet, essentially. So he came in and promised to change all that. And indeed, he began to do that in the early 2000s. And of course, the fact that oil prices went up was a huge benefit. But also, he chose to retake control of the oil sector. It had been largely privatized in the previous years, and there was, a decision, a political decision, to retake control of the oil sector and to use those oil revenues towards these social programs that were extremely popular. So programs that helped with health and education, basic services within poor communities. As Vox was explaining, these programs, they had a redistributive effect, where, the wealth sort of was channeled towards the bottom of society and helped improve a lot of lives of the poor. So it had a political purpose. Obviously, this was his main constituency. It was a mass constituency. But I think it's maybe a little bit exaggerated to consider this to be clientelism, or, I think it's a bit questionable to say, oh, he helped the poor and he was, just doing that for cynical reasons in order to have, essentially more voters. Yes, that's true. But you could also argue that's a good thing for a country like
Venezuela.
But
that's what his voters wanted him to do.
Well, absolutely. That's what he was expected to do. He got an enormous amount of pushback. Some of that pushback took the form of a coup that took place in April of 2002, a coup that was supported by the Bush administration at the time. And the question of whether it's sustainable or not over time, you know, certainly it's difficult to fund a lot of these programs today in Venezuela, and the government's having a great deal of trouble doing that and you know, dealing with massive inflation along with other problems. But, you know, that is not so much due to the fall in oil prices, and oil prices are now sort of hovering around $50 a barrel for Venezuelan heavy crude oil, which is about where they were in real terms in the mid-2000s, when, in fact, these social programs under Chavez had really taken off. So, you know, they're still getting the oil revenue. The problem is that they have a very dysfunctional economy due to their foreign exchange system. And this is a problem that economists, our economists in my center, but economists really everywhere that have been looking at Venezuela agree on, that the foreign exchange system that's in place is creating massive distortions in the economy, is contributing to, you know, at this point, hyperinflation, which, you know, wages in Venezuela are not keeping up with, and contributing to the situation of shortages and high prices, and leading, of course, to a great deal of migration from the country. And Colombia, for instance, has received something like 250,000 Venezuelans over the last year or so.
Let me, before we continue, I want to back up a little bit to a term that Alex used, which is neoliberalism, which is an important term to understand because it certainly is a term that gets discussed a lot more in the last year or so. But the back half of that term, liberalism, I think maybe trips some people up. So let's make sure we understand that we're all talking about the same thing. Because if you go back to the late 1990s, massive income inequality, a collapse of the Venezuelan middle class, and Alex is saying that neoliberalism, largely to blame there, neoliberalism is sort of, I would shorthand it, and it's much more complex than this, is sort of the commoditization of everything and the almost religious belief in markets. How would you describe it?
Yeah, well, it certainly is that. And it's also really putting a disproportionate focus on creating a stable sort of economic climate for investment, with the idea that these countries can only grow with a great deal of foreign investment, direct foreign investment. And this sort of climate means that you have to have really minimal inflation and, you know, a lot of restraints on state activity in the economy so that foreign investors, you know, feel confident. Really, you know, doing what they want to do, being able to invest and pull out their investments, you know, very quickly if need be. It creates security for investors, very little security for, you know, the country and of course, the residents of the country, because these sorts of investments tend to be very fickle and come and go very quickly and can create massive crises when suddenly investors decide that a certain location is too risky. So, but that is sort of the core basis for these sorts of policies that were imposed and, you know, that involved a lot of austerity, reining in public spending, really focusing on the problems of debt and deficit at the expense of economic growth. When, you know, as I'm sure many of your listeners know, when you're in a cycle of an economic downturn, this is a moment when, you know, one way to pull out is for the state to, you know, engage in a lot more spending. And of course, this is what the United States did under the Obama administration to come out of the financial crisis of 2008-2009. Some people would argue that there wasn't enough that was done at that time. But this is sort of an antidote to the problem of economic stagnation and economic decline that is, you know, rejected by one school of economic thought, which is that of neoliberalism, and which is a school that really dominated within the international financial institutions and within Washington and the U.S. Treasury for a very long time, a little bit less so now.
I think when there's economic crisis, just about everyone becomes a Keynesian, even Republicans in Washington. It's just to a different degree, perhaps. But, I mean, they supported stimulus packages that were close to the size of what the Obama administration passed. But setting aside what happens during a crisis, it is true that neoliberalism is a label that gets attached to people like President Obama, to the Bushes and the Clintons and so many others. And so what I want to do now is kind of go through one of the critiques of what happened coming out of that 2004 spike in oil prices, because I don't think this is a neoliberal critique. This is more just sort of a sort of fiscal conservative critique that would say that whatever Chavez's motivations were, once you've got billions in extra to work with, but it might not be, in their words, sustainable, or the fluctuations of an international market in oil prices might mean that the faucet is going to turn off or turn down eventually, that you can't just pour it all into healthcare, education, poverty programs, knowing that you can't sustain that, that it did set up Maduro or whoever or himself, depending on how long his power would last, for failure, and that it was irresponsible, and that that is why it was looked as sort of this venal grab at politicizing his power hold and saying, look what I've done for you now, you know, so the next 5, 10, 15 years be damned. How do you view that? Was it excessive?
Well, again, the main economic or the main source of Venezuela's economic problems today is not, as many people think, the decline in oil prices.
Okay.
This has compounded the problem, but the original source is a very dysfunctional foreign exchange system. And I realize that this is maybe a sort of an obscure point of policy. Obviously, the U.S. doesn't have these sorts of foreign exchange controls. You know, not many countries do. But it's something that when you put it in place originally, it can be very helpful for preventing or reducing capital flight, for instance. And that's why it was originally imposed in Venezuela. But over time, and particularly if you don't have enough foreign cash to pump into the foreign exchange system, it can go completely haywire. That's what we saw in Venezuela, really starting in late 2002, early 2013, when the country no longer had, and in part because of the declining price of oils, no longer had as much foreign cash for the government to put directly into the system. This is a problem that you avoid if you have a free-floating currency. The government doesn't need to have the international reserves, the foreign cash, in its possession. This isn't something that needs to be in the hands of the state, only if they are controlling the foreign exchange system. I don't want to go into too much detail and bore your listeners with this, except that this is really, you know, the crucial factor behind the current crisis. But, I mean, you raise a very good point about, you know, whether it is ultimately sustainable to be so entirely reliant on oil revenue the way Venezuela is. And of course, when oil prices went up starting in 2004, Venezuela went from being their economy being, you know, basically 70% oil revenue to 95% oil revenue, and the public sector grew enormously. These social programs as well grew a lot. And, you know, there's a lot of criticism of Chavez for not having done more to try to diversify the economy and to try to invest in other national industries and so on. He did do a little bit of that, but clearly not enough. And it is a very valid criticism. But I just want to point out that it's a criticism that's valid also for all the preceding governments in Venezuela. So it's not a Hugo Chavez problem per se. It's a problem also of Rafael Caldera, of Carlos Andres Perez, of many other Venezuelan presidents and their administrations that never managed to diversify. It's a very tricky thing to do when you have such a lucrative, state industry like Venezuela's, oil industry. It's something that's difficult to pull off, but that, you know, is certainly worth trying to do.
And I don't mean to sort of sidetrack, but talking about how much one nation can be tied to a single industry like oil, I can't help but wondering this, and I don't want to do a disservice to this discussion by oversimplifying, but I do want to ask how you feel about sort of this international movement to get away from fossil fuels and what that could mean for Venezuela. Because to oversimplify, and to kind of bifurcate things. The American political left tends to be much more aggressive in moving towards alternatives, to calling for, in some cases, an end to the use of fossil fuels, but certainly a reduction in the use of fossil fuels. And the American right, less so. And the American left seems to be more sympathetic to not caricaturing Chavez in the way that they would allege that the American right does. But what happens to Venezuela if the left is successful and we move away from fossil fuels pretty quickly? You know, say it's 5 or 10 years and we see a massive shift away from it. What happens to Venezuela's economy?
So, you know, first thing, I think it's highly unlikely that we'll see a massive shift in the next 5 or 10 years. As beneficial as that, I think, would be to the world.
To the climate problem.
And to the climate problem, certainly. But it's, I don't think that's, you know, really in the works, unfortunately.
That's fair.
But
eventually, know, perhaps.
But certainly eventually, and that is why Venezuela, just like other you know, oil-producing countries that are almost entirely reliant on their oil industry for state revenue, which, you know, is the case of obviously a lot of the states of the Arabian Peninsula, and even countries like, you know, Nigeria, you know, it would make a lot of sense for them to invest in developing these alternatives. And certainly you're seeing this now with big multinational energy companies everywhere. You know, they see what's coming and they have been investing. And even though, you know, they're putting a lot of money into shaping politics in their favor, they're also aware that, you know, fossil fuels is necessarily a losing business in the future. So, you know, that's certainly true for Venezuela as well. Again, you know, Venezuela's been through other crises similar to this one, certainly in the early 1980s. It experienced also, you know, massive inflation, a huge banking crisis, and also very much as a result of sort of the fluctuating prices of oil. So they've been hurt before, and yet, you know, they never managed to quite do enough to diversify their economy the way they need to be to have a stable economy going forward.
I mean, certainly 100 years from now, it's going to be a very different world in energy consumption, and Venezuela will have to have figured it out by then. But even if it's not 100, if it's 50, if it's 20,
absolutely,
or the most aggressive who see the problem as pressing enough to try to get 10, 15 years out, that could lead to a collapse beyond what we're seeing now in Venezuela if they don't diversify, right?
There's no doubt about that. But I think just the one thing I want to highlight is that, you know, a lot of the narrative that you're seeing in the media is that, you know, all of Venezuela's problems are a result of Hugo Chavez's failed policies and homing in on Hugo Chavez and sort of neglecting to mention that, you know, Venezuela has been an oil state since the 1920s. And since the 1920s, they've never really done anything to change this economic model that they have. So it's again, not just a Hugo Chavez problem. It's a Venezuelan problem that sort of transcends the administrations and that certainly is an urgent one that needs correcting.
Listeners, if you want to join the conversation, I invite you to do that. It's 844-295-TALK. That's toll-free, 844-295-8255. Or if you're calling from Rochester, it's 263-WXXI, 263-9994. My guest in studio is Alexander Main, Senior Associate for International Policy at the Center for Economic Policy Research in Washington, D.C. He's in Rochester as a guest of ROCLA, the Rochester Committee on Latin America, and he's giving a presentation tonight called What's the Matter with Venezuela? And it's going on at 7 o'clock tonight. You can attend for free at the Downtown Presbyterian Church. I want to get our only break, and we're going to come back and talk a little bit more about what Alex sees as sort of prescriptions going forward. In other words, if his organization is successful or the goals are advanced, what does it look like for Venezuela? What do we do about what's going on there now? And I also want to contrast the media narratives that we see and ask Alex why he thinks, in his view, if the media is getting it wrong, whether it's in the Times or Vox or the Post or anywhere else, why that's happening. So a lot more to discuss with Alex Main after our only break of the hour here on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, we talk about how the Oscars might have brought some change to different genres, like The Shape of Water, making change for sci-fi, Best Picture, Is this going to bring sci-fi back to the mainstream? And what about Get Out in the horror genre? Of course, it was much more than a horror film, but only 6 horror films have been nominated for Best Picture. What about the role of women in film and all of the conversation there? We'll discuss all that next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. I've an email from a listener named Mark. It's too long to read in its entirety, but let me try to sum it up for you, Alex. Mark says that essentially, he's making the point that he believes that Chavez Maduro is, in his eyes, an indication of proof that socialism or socialistic endeavors can be idealistic and are always collapsing under the weight of people being human. In other words, leaders consolidate power. They are authoritarian. We're seeing authoritarian pushes, at least, and maybe you can correct it if that's not happening, but in Venezuela under this regime, and that Mark is seeing this and saying, look, you can talk all you want about what was going on in the late 90s and Chavez coming into power and what the people in poverty of Venezuela wanted, but ultimately he made decisions to preserve his own power that set up his successor, and that they have been more self-interested in the preservation of power than in actually grappling with difficult long-term problems. He views Chavez and Maduro that way. And that's a pretty common critique. In other words, the talk about socialism is either a boogeyman, or people say, look, I get what you want, but human beings have to run systems, and human beings are very corruptible. And this is another example. What do you say to that?
Okay, well, yeah, there's a lot to unpack there. I'd like to sort of just address the point of socialism and then the point of authoritarianism really quickly. And on socialism, well, you know, I think it's very difficult actually to call the current Venezuelan government or the government under Hugo Chavez socialist. Certainly, Chavez called for socialism in 2006, said he wanted to take the country towards socialism. But, you know, ultimately, the sort of economic model that we've already been discussing has not changed fundamentally in Venezuela. Sure, there have been some nationalizations of, you know, a few big companies, of a big bank, and so on. But, you know, this doesn't go anywhere beyond what we've seen, for instance, in a variety of Western European countries, you know, in the 1960s, 1970s. So, at best, I think you can sort of call it a social democratic sort of leaning. And when you look at, for instance, Venezuela's tax system and so on, it's highly regressive compared to the U.S. tax system. You're much better off being a wealthy person in Venezuela than in the U.S., I'm afraid to say, simply because you're much less likely to be heavily taxed and so on. So we're not really seeing a socialist system in Venezuela today. We are seeing certainly some economic mismanagement. You can argue that some of that took place under Chavez. But again, I think the major dysfunctions that we've seen in the economy, and let's remember that the economy was really booming until around 2012 or so, and growing, you know, at sort of an average rate of over 2% a year, you know, a very healthy rate, certainly for Latin America. And then things started to go very rapidly downhill. And that's because there were a few policies in place, not at all socialist in nature. I've talked about it quite a lot now. The foreign exchange system is extremely flawed, but it's a sort of system that you don't see necessarily in socialist governments at all. In fact, it's a sort of system that the International Monetary Fund has at times promoted in certain countries, in Bolivia, Argentina, some Southeast Asian countries in the past, with sometimes very disastrous effects similar to what we're seeing in Venezuela today. So that's really my take on sort of the socialist part of it. I think what we've seen is sort of the intention to take Venezuela towards socialism, but we can't actually criticize it certainly not criticize the socialist policies in Venezuela, because there aren't really any socialist policies in Venezuela. In terms of the authoritarianism, I think it's, you know, important. I think one thing that people aren't aware of is that Venezuela is the country that's probably had the most national elections since you know Chavez was first elected in 1998, of any country, certainly in the region, perhaps the world. So we're talking at this point, and I think I've lost count, but I think we're up to 18 or 19 elections, national elections in that time period. So far more than in the U.S., for instance, where the main national elections take place every 2 years. In Venezuela, it's been an average of more than one per year over this time period. These elections, for the most part, have been really certified as transparent and free and fair by international observers. The problem we have is that the last few years, there haven't been international observers. There's a different system of international accompaniment. But on the whole, you have, opposition parties in Venezuela that have participated. There's a system of audits around the electoral processes, which is absolutely unprecedented in the world. So I think that's one thing that needs to be taken into account when you're talking about authoritarianism in Venezuela.
But do you trust the recent elections under Maduro?
Well, yes, for the most part. I mean, let's remember that in 2015, the National Assembly election, so that's the main, that's the legislative branch of power, the opposition, won massively, and understandably, because, at that time, Venezuela was already experiencing a severe economic crisis, and that's always going to punish, an incumbent party. And so that's certainly what we saw in 2015, the issue is Venezuela is highly polarized, and you have had, certainly since the beginning of the 2000s, basically two sides on the political divide that don't accept the legitimacy of the other. Literally do not. So, for instance, when Nicolas Maduro was first elected president in April of 2013, following the death of Hugo Chavez, those elections certainly had international observation, were certainly endorsed as being free and fair and so on, but the opposition refused to recognize them. And since then, has basically said, no, we're not recognizing this president. He's not our president. That's been sort of the mainstream position within the opposition coalition of Venezuela. And Maduro has sort of lashed out and fought back. And one of the main things he's done is he created a constituent assembly. So this is something that he can do under the Constitution. But the way that it was done is something that is, arguably not as democratic as in past elections, in that these elections were done with representation by sector. And it was something that I think some of the opposition felt legitimately that, was rigged against them and they didn't want to participate in these elections. On the other hand, some opposition analysts said they should have and they probably would have won those elections. But at any rate, they didn't participate in those elections, so you can't really see those elections as legitimate. And you have now this constituent assembly, which serves as sort of a parallel legislative body because you have this crisis, really, this institutional crisis, where you have, on the one hand, the president of the country, and other branches of the government as well, including the judicial branch, that are not recognizing the legislative branch, and the legislative branch that is not recognizing them, and they're each sort of doing their own thing. So the institutions are not functioning properly, and this creates an extremely polarized atmosphere, and I would argue that it's been just one long political crisis over the last few years, essentially since Hugo Chavez died at the end of or at the beginning of 2013.
Alex said earlier, my guest, by the way, Alex Main, who is a senior associate for international policy at the Center for Economic Policy Research in Washington, D.C., said earlier that the largely attributed causes of the unrest in Venezuela and the crisis in Venezuela tend to be oversimplified by American media, that he talked about international exchange, talked about United States' role. In a moment, I want to follow up with Alex and see what he thinks the United States' role has been in creating this. But if you're just joining us and you've seen the headlines over the last year, wherever the source of the headlines is, they're talking about a Venezuelan population that is largely unable to afford food and medicine. Those things true right now?
Yes, that is largely true.
Okay.
I mean, they they can't afford food for the most part. I mean, there is this idea that there is now widespread starvation in Venezuela. That I do not think is a real sort of situation. What you do have certainly is people not being able to afford the sort of food that they did before, and a great deal of malnutrition. So, you know, a very difficult situation to live in, and that's why a lot of Venezuelans today are trying to leave the country, and many have.
And Vox reporting on the currency said that Maduro set the exchange rate at 10 bolivares per dollar, but only his friends and allies have access to this rate. For most Venezuelans, they're roughly exchanging 12,000 bolivares to one on the black market. Now, this is of last year. I don't know if that's still true.
Right. Well, this is the whole dysfunctioning system that I've been describing.
Yeah.
I mean, you have this massive gap between the official rate. It's now much higher than 10, by the way.
Okay.
It's now at 3,000 is...
Okay.
But on the other hand, the black market rate, which is what, you know, most people use to change their dollars or to change their bolivars into dollars, is at 30,000. So you have this massive difference. And what it amounts to is that, you know, the Venezuelan government, by continuing to, you know, put foreign exchange into this system, is subsidizing certain sectors of the economy. Certainly, yes, those that are closer to the government, you know, that have sort of a privileged position where they have access to dollars, but also certain, you know, businesses in Venezuela. But they are essentially being massively subsidized by the state because they are able to buy foreign exchange at a way, way below market price.
Okay. On the subject of the U.S., we'll get there in just a second. Let me grab a phone call. This is Herman in Brighton. Go ahead, Herman.
Hi. Whenever I listen to Maduro, whenever I used to listen to Chavez, they struck me as typical demagogues. They use all the techniques that are classic of demagogues. They whip up anger and resentment and outrage, and they always find a whipping boy to blame all the problems of the country on. Of course, any demagogue will blame the opposition, but in addition to that, very often they blame a foreign country. And of course, the U.S. is the favorite whipping boy. And that's not to say that the U.S. didn't do some stupid things, but a demagogue will blame all of their problems on anybody but themselves, and then try to convince the people that they are the one that can fix everything. They'll just vote for them and, you know, give them the power, including in some cases extraordinary power. And I think it's really important to recognize demagogues when we see them, especially since, unfortunately, we're stuck with one here in the U.S. right now.
Herman, thank you for the phone call. So let's take two ways, Alex. Number one, Chavez, Maduro, he sees them as demagogues. I want to know if you agree. And number two, he says that their favorite whipping boy has been the United States. Well, you hinted that you do think the United States has some culpability here. So let's take that two ways. Are they demagogues?
Well, yeah, I think probably at times they are demagogues. But I also think that the image that we have of both of these rulers is a very selective one, where the media is going to pounce on some of the most sensationalist sort of material that they can come across. And when you really see, you know, both of these rulers at their worst, essentially, or certainly at their worst from an outside perspective. But, you know, again, I want to go back to what I was saying before, that this is a very, very highly polarized environment. And, you know, you're seeing that on the one hand. What you're not seeing as much in the media is, you know, sort of a similar level of demagoguery coming from the opposition, you know, perhaps even more so at times. And again, let's remember that the opposition in Venezuela, not all of the opposition, but certainly a lot of the opposition, was involved in a military coup in April of 2002 against a democratically elected president, President Hugo Chavez at the time. And, you know, after that, they remained unrepentant. You know, perhaps to his credit, Chavez didn't try to throw them all in jail, and they continued activities of destabilization over time, including, sabotaging of the oil industry. A lot of the higher management of the oil industry was on their side, and shut down the oil industry. It took Venezuela into its deepest recession of all time, deeper than what we're seeing now. The thing is, it wasn't very prolonged. But it was extremely painful. And this was all in an effort to try to destabilize the administration, again, that had been democratically elected. And again, there have been elections at a rate of at least one a year. And I think this is the thing that we have to remember. We may disagree with their style, but ultimately they're doing something that has allowed them to continue to win large majorities in elections. And let me remind also the listeners that in Venezuela, the turnout in elections, it's much higher than the U.S. So ultimately, it's sort of a more democratic sort of representation. You have as much as 80% of voters that show up to vote, and okay. that have, with the exception of recent elections, have voted, pretty massively in favor of this project. And so, have been benefiting from it. And I think, we need to recognize that and sort of respect that as, we might not like the style of these guys very much, but, ultimately, if we want to be Democrats, we have to recognize that they're democratically elected.
When it comes to the United States' role, and Herman saying he feels like the United States was the favorite whipping boy, what culpability do you see the United States having for what's going on in Venezuela?
Well, I'm afraid a lot. When you look at the April 2002 coup that, we've now mentioned a couple of times, that was supported by a lot of the opposition, there was some research that was done afterwards, some FOIA research that showed that a lot of these opposition groups were receiving funding and training from the U.S., a lot of new opposition groups as opposed to sort of the traditional political parties. Ones that had no real experience being in power and that were generally from the Venezuelan elites that were extremely resentful and felt displaced by Chavez when he came to power. So the U.S. Was sort of instrumental in increasing, their own political strength within Venezuela. And, these were sectors that were often involved in, again, destabilization campaigns, like the coup, like this oil lockout that I described, and others since then, I would argue, including some of these protests that we saw in 2014, 2017, that while they had, for the most part, a lot of peaceful protesters and so on, had also contingent within them that tried to create as much chaos as possible with the explicit aim of trying to get a military intervention, either international or domestic military intervention to try to remove the government extra constitutionally. So the U.S. has been involved in sort of promoting these sectors a great deal. And more recently, under President Trump, well, really starting under President Obama, you've had sanctions against Venezuela. They were started during the protests of 2014. Originally, they targeted individuals. You now have sanctions that are financial sanctions that are essentially preventing Venezuela from borrowing on international markets and also for restructuring their very high debt. So this is tying their hands enormously. And at a time when Venezuela really needs foreign cash and to be able to borrow foreign cash in order to achieve some form of economic recovery, they're not able to do that. And the Trump sanctions are there to really make the Venezuelan economy worse, to make it scream, as I think Kissinger said about the sanctions against the Salvador Allende government back in the early 1970s. Absolutely, I think, perhaps the U.S. at times has been, used in an excessive manner as a foil to try to whip up, nationalist you know, support and so on for the Chavez and Maduro government. Today, we really can say that the U.S. government is doing a lot of damage in Venezuela, in a country that's already very damaged, making the situation worse. And you know, it's a very dangerous thing. It's a crisis that could end up boiling over.
Ted writes to us and says, Venezuela is suffering because oil production has been reduced by over 50%, costing the country more than $30 billion annually. This is the result of state ownership of the oil industry and socialism. All of the explaining away by your guest sounds like propaganda. The state also took over ownership of the auto industry, which has also collapsed. And I would like your guest to disclose how his institute is paid.
Okay, well, I'll address that last question before. It's funny that anytime you know we say anything that can be perceived as positive about a left-wing government in Latin America, we get that question.
I don't have a problem with the question.
No, I have no problem with the question
okay,
either.
Okay, good.
But we receive no government funding of any kind, unlike a lot of organizations like ours in the Beltway, in the Washington, D.C. area. Neither from the U.S. government nor from any other government, you know, and certainly not the Venezuelan government in any form. Our funding comes primarily from foundations and comes also from some private individuals.
What's an example of one of the foundations that funds you?
Well, Rockefeller Brothers, Ford Foundation.
Okay.
You know, people can take a look at our webpage at cepr.net and see that, you know, for one thing, we're not just focused on Venezuela. We do a lot of work on the domestic U.S. economy. One of our economists, Dean Baker, was the first to identify the housing bubble as early as 2002. Lots of work on Social Security and other big issues.
Now, back to Ted's email. He's, again, pointing to the decline in oil production, and you have pushed back against that this hour.
Well, yes. It's a problem. I don't see exactly why what I'm saying is propagandistic, because, you know, the oil price decline has, you know, caused a lot of economic turmoil throughout the world. It's increased that of Venezuela. I have acknowledged that Venezuela is heavily oil reliant, and that is a problem, and they need to diversify. So I'm critical of the government from that point of view. I'm also critical of the government from another point of view that I think is generally not really acknowledged in the media, although, again, many economists, plenty of economists. There's a very well-known Venezuelan economist named Francisco Rodriguez agrees with us that the foreign exchange system is a major problem. I think this constitutes also a major critique of Venezuelan government economic policy. So I don't really see how it's propagandistic.
And looking at from your lens on how the turmoil can start to be mitigated, what is step one? What is sort of a functionally reachable goal here that would start to change that?
Well, we're seeing something right now. There are presidential elections that are scheduled for May. And
are they going to be internationally observed?
They could be. We don't know yet. And, you know, this is something that we should certainly encourage. We should encourage international observation. So just to give a little bit of background, you know, elections were supposed to take place this year for the presidency. They're taking place earlier than normal. The normal sort of schedule for the elections would be as late as November, even December, for these elections. And I think the fact that they're taking place so early is because, you know, the Venezuelan government feels that they have a better opportunity of doing well now rather than later. So we can certainly see that as a problem, that they're doing that in terms of when the elections are being scheduled. But the opposition in Venezuela is divided over the elections. So you have the main opposition coalition, the Unified Democratic Platform, the MUD by its initials in Spanish, which is boycotting. But you have some groups and leaders from the coalition that have broken off and are going to be participating in the election. And you have one, you know, fairly notable opposition leader, Henry Falcón, a former state governor in Venezuela, who's going to be participating in these elections. And in order to win him over, in order to have, you know, elections that seem legitimate, and to have legitimate elections, you need an opposition, the Venezuelan government has agreed to a pretty strong framework for these elections in terms of the sort of guarantees around their transparency, around equitable, access to the media and so on for the candidates. According to polls, Henry Falcón could easily win these elections.
Could win.
He has, most polls show him having a 7 or 8 point lead against Maduro. So he has a real chance.
And again, that's May.
And that's in May.
That's coming up.
I think a big presidential election is a way potentially of solving the crisis. Again, one can question the timing of these elections. From the government's point of view, I think it favors them. On the other hand, we're also dealing with a major crisis, and it's perhaps a good thing to have an electoral contest coming up soon to try to resolve things peacefully, because frankly, we've been at the brink of civil war in Venezuela now a number of times over the last few years.
All right, down to our last 40 seconds, which is amazing. The hour just vanished here. American media, I know you're not always satisfied with what you see in terms of the coverage in Latin America and Venezuela. What are the sources of news that you do prefer?
Well, yeah, that's not any, I think what... listeners need to do is really just, try to read from many sources, multiple sources of information. There aren't a lot of in-depth sources. One that I would recommend is NACLA, the North American Congress on Latin America. They have a website that has a lot of articles with alternative news on Venezuela and also sort of the rest of Latin America that is written by academics and real experts that provide a lot more depth, a lot more context than you're likely to see in most of the major media. So that's NACLA, NACLA.org.
And the website for your organization, Alex, is what?
So ours, we have plenty of material on Venezuela and other Latin American countries there as well. It's www.cepr.net, N-E-T.
And that's the Center for Economic Policy Research in Washington, Alexander Main, my guest for the hour. He is a guest of the Rochester Committee on Latin America, and you can see him tonight. What's the Matter with Venezuela? An expansion of the conversation you just heard. That is at 7 p.m. tonight at the Downtown Presbyterian Church on North Fitzhugh. Thanks for the time this hour. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
All right, short break. More Connections coming up.